The attack has been ordered. They were told to launch their offensive at dawn today.
Is there going to be a problem? Is there going to be a time when Nephron wants to leave?
Persephone looked northeast at the trees and saw nothing. She looked at the sky. It was already evening.
And yet they don't appear to be attacking. Why is that?
Because every once in a very great while, the gods are kind.
This has something to do with the horn, doesn't it?
Yes. Lothian ordered the attack, but last night every member of his army heard that horn blow.
Nephron jabbed a finger in the direction of the forest.
They all know the Fane is dead, and they have no more idea what that means than we do. So they wait for new orders.
By sunset tonight, either there will be a new Fane, or someone else will blow the horn and a battle will be scheduled. Either way, we have a brief window to act in.
But we also gain one thing. We now know they have an army complete with dragons.
I wouldn't make such a point of it if staying will be an obvious choice.
The new Fane might not choose to attack, she said.
Nephron looked at her incredulous.
You can't actually believe that.
Our scouts have identified dozens of dragons. Dozens, Persephone. Suri told me that dragons are made by killing loved ones. No matter who the Fane is, how can they stop the war now?
No, this change of Fane alters nothing.
But it has saved us from annihilation. It has granted us just enough time to pull up stakes and fall back beyond the range of their dragons.
Persephone stared over the fallen tents at the misty haze of the forest eaves.
If you leave, you will lose the war.
We can't leave, she said.
Persephone, it's suicide on a grand scale to remain here, open and exposed the way we are.
It serves no point. With Ellison dead and your southern army eaten, we have no reason to remain.
Timing is everything. We can't leave, she insisted.
Of course we can. If we retreat just 20 miles, we'll put the burn between us and them. It's not even a question at this point.
You're right. It isn't. We aren't leaving.
She shouted to the workmen.
Stop what you're doing. Put these tents back up. We aren't going anywhere.
Nephron's eyes widened. He grabbed her by the elbow and pulled her aside, forcing her feet into deeper snow.
What are you doing?
He spoke low enough not to be heard, but loud enough to infuse his words with anger.
You aren't in command here, Persephone replied. You should have asked me before starting any of this. I thought we ruled together, he said. These men follow me. I don't wish to be cruel, don't want to embarrass you, but I won't allow your foolishness to jeopardize the lives of hundreds of soldiers,
Nephron said.
I'm not playing here. I'm serious.
So am I.
We are in this situation because you gave Sori to the Fane and she gave him dragons. You lost this conflict for us. You don't understand war. I do. We will all die if we don't leave, and leave now.
Forgive me, but I can't allow your inexperience to destroy us.
He grabbed her by the wrist and began pulling her back toward the tent.
Stop it, she told him.
He ignored her, hauling onward. She jerked back, but his fingers gripped like a row, and his arm was iron. She had no footing on the snow. She slipped and nearly fell.
Let go, she growled.
The men working on the tents stopped to look. Those digging snow, carrying wood, coiling rope, watched the spectacle of Nephron towing his wife down the path. Not one interfered. No one would dare insert themselves in a fight between husband and wife.
Maybe if he started hitting me, if he drew his sword.
She was certain that if Nephron threatened to kill her, they would restrain him. But short of that, marriage bestowed certain rights, one of which was the privilege to quarrel with your spouse. She continued to resist. He jerked hard. She fell in the snow. Rather than let her get up, Nephron dragged her. The tie of Justine's cloak came loose as she skidded across the snow.
Damn you! She screamed at him. You son of a bitch!
He did not look at her. his grim face locked on the destination of the tent.
"Stop it!"
she shouted and jerked. He pulled harder, spinning her. The nape of her dress dipped and snow slipped down the back of her neck, chilling her.
"Let me go!"
she screamed. Nephron ignored her, but on the nearby hilltop, Persephone saw something move. The outline of a summit that hadn't changed in ages was different. No one would interfere between a husband and wife except...
"Nephron! Nephron, let go! Let go!" she cried with new urgency. "Nephron, let go or you're going to die!"
"Please don't make this worse than it already is," he told her.
"That's exactly what I'm telling you!"
She remembered a moment from years before, back in Dol Ren, when she was about to face Conniger, and Wraith had told her, "Persephone, if you have any problem, yell. Yell real loud and then get out of the way. I'll do the rest." Nephron didn't know where the dragon had come from, how exactly it was made. In her head, she heard its words again.
"Even now."
She had to do something, but she came up with nothing. Nephron wasn't letting go, and he had given up listening to her. Persephone was jerked again, her face nearly hitting the snow. Then she was on her back, her legs kicking like a flipped beetle. She would have been upset at the indignity, except a real horror was drowning her thoughts. For at that moment, she looked back at the hill. The dragon was gone. She felt a growing wind that only she understood. Tents, the one still standing, began to shudder, shake, and flap. It hadn't been snowing, but snow filled the air. It didn't fall. It swirled. Thrump, thrump, thrump.
"The dragon, you fool!"
she screamed, pointing up with her free hand. Persephone was pleased to discover that the terror in her voice finally got through to her husband. Nephron's concern was finally triggered by her panic. He stopped and looked up. Some had already started running, toppling over buckets and tripping over bundles of wool still blocking the pathway. As the shadow enveloped the entire camp, people screamed. Nephron finally let go, but it was too late. The gusts and thrusts stopped as the dragon folded its wings and dropped like a falcon onto the Frey commander. One giant claw with sword-length talons landed, pinning Nephron to the ground. Then that great mouth of vicious teeth opened.
"Stop!"
Persephone shouted at the creature. She had rolled to her knees and had both arms raised.
"Don't hurt him!"
At the sound of her voice, the dragon hesitated. Its lips pulled back into a sneer, showing still more teeth. One big eye fixed on her, the tall, elongated pupils snapping her into focus. The great beast released a deep, ground-shaking growl and let go a snort of hot air that blew back the edges of Persephone's cloak and tossed her hair.
"Please," she told it.
Her heart pounded, and she wondered how she was able to talk.
"Don't."
Nephron lay on his back in the snow, pinned by the claw as if the roots of a tree had grown over him. His head was trapped between two great talons, the webbing of the claw up around his neck. Barely breathing, he didn't say a word. Although Nephron was arrogant, self-centered, and frequently unsympathetic, he wasn't stupid. For once, he was perfectly willing, eager, to let her command the situation.
I need him alive.
Persephone spoke to the dragon, but looked at Nephron.
He's my husband.
She turned to those still watching, the ones spellbound by what they saw, or too scared to move. Sikar ran toward them with sword drawn, but stopped short when he saw Nephron under the claw.
"He hurt you."
The dragon spoke with cavernous timbre. The voice could have been that of a mountain or a god. Gasps escaped the crowd.
"He didn't."
Persephone held up her hands, revealing she wasn't sure what.
"There
they were still there? I'm all right. I am. He... Again, she looked into Nephron's eyes, speaking to him, willing him to go along. Would never really hurt me. We just had a disagreement. Husbands and wives have those. He was angry, and so was I. But he wasn't going to hurt me. Were you?
No.
Nephron shook his head so slightly it appeared as if he was shivering, and maybe he was. Even the leader of the Galentians might show fear when pinned by an invulnerable dragon.
I only sought to...
The great claw tightened. Talons dragged, digging deep furrows into the snow, ploughing up dirt and last year's grass. The crowd gasped again, and several retreated. Others raised defending hands to shield their frightened eyes. Persephone rushed forward and placed a hand on the dragon's claw.
Stop!
Again, the beast listened. Again, it hesitated.
This war isn't over. I need him, and he is my husband.
She paused. Persephone looked around at the men with mallets and shovels, women with buckets and baskets, so many she didn't recognize, so many strangers. She straightened up and spoke directly to the crowd.
And I am Koenig. I know the Fane's army is advancing. I know they have dragons. I know our situation appears impossible. But I also know what most of you are too young to remember, that I have done the impossible before, and more than once. And I remember.
Habit stepped forward. Habit, who had been missing all day, reappeared. He was dressed in soaked travelling clothes, looking haggard and sweaty. Without pause or concern, he walked right up to Persephone and the dragon. He reached out and patted the dragon's side three times, smiling as he did. Then he turned to Persephone.
I remember it all. I was there. I was always there. You gave us food when we were starving, killed the bad bear no one else could, moved us to the sea when our dhal was destroyed, brought back the shiny sword from far away, and had Moya kill that ugly Gula.
He made a fierce face, then laughed.
You remember all that?
Habit nodded like a pigeon.
I remember you said, trust me. You said it, and we did it.
She smiled at him. Then she turned back to the crowd. Now I'm asking everyone to trust me again. My command is that we stay here. We do not run. It might seem a foolish thing, but if we leave now, we will most assuredly lose this war. The Frey can always make more dragons, so there is nowhere that is safe. They will hunt us down and kill us all. If we stay... She didn't know how to finish. She was working blind, believing in a man who wanted her to trust him.
You only need to trust me one more time. If I'm right, this war will be over and my reign as Koenig will end. But for now we stay.
No one spoke. There wasn't so much as a cough, and the winter's stillness was as complete as if the world had stopped. Everything paused, waiting on her to start it again. Persephone dusted snow off her hands, brushed hair from her face, and once more tried and failed to pull Justine's cloak around her. There was just no way to look dignified in an ill-fitting wrap.
Let him go, she told the beast. I need him. We need him. The world needs him.
The claw opened.
Return to your hill, she told it. We may yet need you as well.
Gusts of downdrafts exploded against the ground, throwing up snow and sending bales of wool tumbling. In that blinding swirl of dragon-made blizzard, Persephone walked to Habit and gave him a hug.
Welcome back, she said. Where did you go?
I went for a ride.
Bryn raced the sun, and it was winning. She chased it west, watching as it flew farther and farther away. It shifted from white to yellow to a now frightening shade of orange. The trip through the swamp had been as ideal as Muriel had promised. The word enchanted came to mind. The muddy water had frozen, its surface dusted with a thin coating of snow that was just enough to provide good traction. Finding her way was simple. A path had been made for her. The trees themselves had lined up to create a corridor that blocked the wind. Maybe it had always been there, and in the dark they hadn't seen it. But that morning it felt as if the swamp held her hand. She felt that hand let go when she reached the field and ran out of the swamp. The last time she was there, it had been a beautiful fall day of bright colors and an easy downhill stroll. Now Bryn struggled uphill through a frozen, windswept landscape of snow and bare trees. She'd hoped to find Narisbur still tethered, but the horse was gone, and she was left to hike. The sun was well overhead as she began that arduous half-circle swing around the mountain. She was feeling strong and confident, which didn't make much sense. She'd been dead for several days, her body inert and packed in ice-cold mud. No food, no water, no air. And since hopping back inside and taking up the reins of those arms and legs, she'd had only one night to rest. When Arion had woken after her near death, it had taken weeks for her to recuperate, alternating between sipping water and vomiting it back up. Yet here was Bryn, switching back and forth between a fast walk and a trot after already covering what had to be miles. She hadn't been hungry or thirsty. That was the clue that led Bryn to suspect the stew. When it came to the Tetlin witch, everyone knew that her food and drink were enchanted. In the stories, eating or drinking anything she offered invited disaster. Muriel was a different story, and that tiny breakfast continued to fill her stomach with warmth and strength for longer than it should have. But by the time Bryn cleared the swamp, her stamina was fading. Then thirst rolled in with a vengeance. She took to stuffing handfuls of snow into her mouth as she trudged on. The snow took some of the pain away, but it couldn't satisfy her need for water. She began to grow hungry too. She gave up trotting altogether, sticking only to a fast walk. By staying close to a line of bushes that made a snow shadow, she was rewarded with a path of bare ground. Bryn was still making good time, but she was rapidly running out of strength. And as the sun, unwilling to wait for her, ran ahead, Bryn noticed the cold. She'd been hot and sweating most of the day, but as the shadows lengthened and she stopped running, her wet clothes chilled her. Then the wonderful line of bushes ended, and with it, the clear path. Bryn stopped at the edge of that hedgerow, panting. "This is where we had our last meal together before entering the swamp. I ate an apple. The core might still be around, somewhere under the snow." Her breath created clouds. "Has that been happening all along, but I've been moving too fast to notice? Or is it getting colder?" She shivered. "It's getting colder." She felt the clammy grip of her tunic, which was soaked through with sweat. Her legs were tight and tired, her feet sore, where she could feel them. Her toes were going numb. Bryn looked ahead, trying to pick a good route. There wasn't one. The world before her was a sea of white. Everywhere, snow was ankle deep or higher. "Going to slow me down." She noticed how much taller her shadow was. In the sky, the sun was going down. She clutched the horn to her chest. "Ilan, give me strength. I can't do this alone, and you said you'd be with me." She waited a moment, hoping for something. A word, a sign. Nothing materialized. Not a single bird chirped. Bryn clamped her jaw tight and pushed forward into the snow. Her speed was instantly reduced. She went from a fast walk to a labored trudge. Soon, she was marking the passage of each footfall, concentrating on forcing her legs to move, her feet to land. "Up, down, up, down," she said in her head, mentally ordering her feet to move, matching her footfalls to the beats of the words. Up, down, up, down. This is how we cover ground. The second part fell into place with a sing-song rhythm. Bryn didn't know how she thought of it, didn't know she was thinking at all, but once it was there, she chanted it with gusto. Up, down, up, down. This is how we cover ground. She bent her head, watching her own progress. Like a spectator, she observed how snow collected in the tops of her shoes. She could see it packing against the skin of her ankles, and how red her flesh became. That's not good. That's going to be a real problem. Might lose that foot altogether if this keeps up. The thought was a disconnected observation, as if this was happening to someone else. Someone she felt sorry for. Someone she knew was doomed. Up, down, up, down. This is how we cover ground. She entered a ravine where a cluster of large, snow-covered rocks created mounds. A few juniper and thyme bushes grew up one slope. Up, down, up, down. Bryn grabbed more snow and sucked it into her parched mouth. This is how we cover ground. The sun was turning red. The day was ending. She had failed. That poor young woman with the snow-filled shoes was going to die in the snow just miles from her goal. Bryn couldn't help feeling sorry for her. Then she heard the snort of a horse, followed by a whinny. I've gone mad, she realized as she looked up and saw none other than Narrowspur, fully tacked and tethered before her. Looped over the saddle were a skin of water and a bag of bread and cheese. This isn't where you were, she told the horse. Behind Narrowspur was a clear trench of packed snow, as if someone had walked while dragging their feet. Bryn lifted her face to the sky. Thank you, Elan. Nefren slipped into the tent. He never spent much time there. This was Persephone's place. Hers, the kids, and the nurses. It smelled like them, too. He stood for a moment just inside the tent flap, listening. All three were gone. He didn't know where. The sun was setting, the light soaking through the canvas with a gold color. He moved quickly, lifting the sword off the tent post. The naked blade caught the sun's light and shimmered. Black bronze. It was a brilliant gleam, and in the metal he saw symbols, finely etched markings lining both sides of the blade. For nearly a decade, Nefren had allowed others to fight for him. Frey can't kill Frey, but this was an enemy he was allowed to slay. Since having been thrown on his back, Nefren had spent time considering his future. All of it distilled down to but one of two bad choices. He could walk out and abandon Persephone and her people. Sikar and the other Frey would follow him. They could retreat to Meridid, hole up there, and watch as the human army was wiped out. But what then? Wanderlei and his Miraleth huntsmen would track him down. The rest of his life would be spent fleeing that spineless brat, until at last he died in some muddy hole, or, worse, was dragged back to be displayed and humiliated like his father had been. His other option was to force the army to retreat, which would require Mwandulay to order more dragons. Though the chance of success was slim, this option offered at least the possibility that the new Fane might face enough anger back home to give up. As much as he hated the idea, Nefren might be forced to acquiesce to peace. Better than dying in a muddy hole. Nefren searched for Malcolm, but failed to find the infuriating man. This left him but one option. As long as the dragon remained, Persephone would not retreat, and with it as her guardian, he couldn't force her. So Nefren climbed the hill with the sword in his hand. The dragon lay where it had been, but in a different stance. In 2 years, the creature hadn't moved until Persephone screamed, so Nephron fully expected the beast to remain statue-like now. He didn't attempt to hide his approach or his intent. He held the sword confidently, swinging it with his strides as he climbed the last few feet. He was nearing the top when the dragon's head came up. Nephron froze. The beast was bigger than a house, but it jerked up with the speed of a cat. The thing's eyes flashed open and narrowed on him. Its lips rippled up, revealing stalactite fangs.
"You've come to kill me."
The runic words rumbled out of the giant mouth. Nephron hadn't expected it to talk. Not to him. "Your services are no longer needed."
"How rude,"
the dragon said, surprising him.
"Even for a fray, that's ill-mannered. So, you're a great warrior, then. I'm a little disappointed. I expected you'd be taller. The tails certainly are. Do you think you could kill me?"
The words were familiar. They came from the past. Nephron had said them himself. A conversation outside Dalren's wooden gate.
"Do you know who I am?"
The beast rose up. Its wings flashed out and its neck arched up and back. Nephron narrowed his eyes. "Not possible, is it?" "It requires a sacrifice," Suri had said. "I have to destroy the life of someone dear to me."
"God killer?"
The great dragon's lips tightened, showing more pointed teeth.
"How's your back? Hitting the snow like that looked really painful."
Nephron advanced.
"She loves me, not you,"
the beast declared. That stopped Nephron, who paused to laugh. "Persephone," he said. "I don't care about her. Did you think I wooed her away from you because I loved her?"
"You care about losing."
"I didn't lose. You're dead, and will be more so in a moment."
"I'm in Alison, and in a few years she will be too. But you won't. This battle doesn't end here. This is only the beginning. So tell me, Frey, do you think you can kill me?"
Even Nolan couldn't sleep through what had happened. Justine, with Persephone's son in tow, eventually found her not far from an enormous claw print where the Kenik was busy reordering the camp. The look on the nursemaid's face, which sported a very strained and extremely brave smile, made Persephone wonder if Justine was rethinking her decision to care for the Kenik son. She held out Persephone's cloak, and they traded. "I grabbed yours by mistake," Persephone said. "Sorry, got a little wet." Justine nodded blankly as Nolan hung from her grip like a wet sack. His drooping eyes and long face told the tale of a boy who'd just gotten up, wasn't awake yet, and wasn't happy about it. "What happened?" Justine asked. "Nothing. Nothing important." The big thing, Persephone knew, was still coming. What that thing was, she didn't know. But as the sun was close to setting, she was tired of waiting. "Have you seen Malcolm?" "Over there," Justine said, pointing north. "Passed him on the way here." "Show me." The young woman hoisted a disagreeable Nolan up on one hip so that the boy's feet bobbed as she walked. His head toppled over her shoulder. She led the way down between rows of tents until Persephone could see Malcolm for herself. He was standing with his back to her near the edge of the camp, where the mass of regimented tents stopped and the field began. Persephone stopped Justine. "I see him, and I can take it from here." Conversations with Malcolm weren't meant to be shared, and that was never more true than now. She looked at Nolan, his head resting against Justine's neck, thumb in mouth. eyes open, but only a crack. She had an incredible urge to grab her son and hug him tight against whatever storm was coming. She wanted to shield him, save him, the way she hadn't saved the others. Persephone had had 3 children with Raglan, but only Marn had lived to maturity, an adulthood cut horribly short. Now she had Nolan, beautiful, perfect, and her last chance. Persephone knew she couldn't save him with a hug. "Take him," she told Justine, trying to sound as calm as possible. "Get him something to eat. It'll be dark soon." The nursemaid cupped the back of Nolan's head with her hand as she nodded. Persephone saw a hesitancy there, a lingering, apprehensive look.
"All right,"
Justine said, with an odd sort of finality, as if accepting a grim and dangerous mission. Then, unexpectedly, she reached out and hugged Persephone. The 3 of them shared a squeeze that was hard to break from. Persephone pushed back.
"Take him. Keep Nolan safe. I will."
Persephone didn't watch them go. She pushed forward, swallowing the remaining distance between her and Malcolm. He must have known she was there. "He knows everything, but refuses to share." As she approached, he remained with his back to her, his cloak wrapped tightly against the growing cold.
"Sun setting," she said.
"Yes," he replied, but he wasn't looking that way. He stared east into the growing darkness at Mount Mador, whose lower half was in shadow, the upper still dazzling with the final rays of the day's light.
"What's going to happen, Malcolm?"
He had his arms folded across his chest, his face red with wind burn, his eyes straining to see. What he looked for, she couldn't begin to guess.
"It's too cold. And there's too much snow."
"Too much for what, Malcolm?"
The ground shook, and a terrible roar came from Dragon Hill.
"I tried my best," Malcolm told her sadly. "You must understand that. Some knots are too tight to untie. Some must be cut."
Persephone rushed past him into the snowy field, clearing the camp to see north. The dragon had moved again. The beast was in the air, its great wings holding it aloft with regular beats that shuddered the nearby tents, threatening to blow them down. It wasn't alone. Nephron stood on the hill's crest, with the black bronze blade held aloft, aimed at the beast, holding the sword with both hands, arms extended. The 2 combatants were caught in the same brilliance of the setting sun. Evening light illuminated the shimmering scales on the Gilarabrin's body, revealing their iridescence. That same radiance transformed Nephron's armor into a golden mirror. For a moment, Persephone could do nothing except stare. The vision was more than striking. It inspired awe. Compared with the dragon, Nephron was tiny, but oh so bright and oh so brave. His little sword gleamed both red and gold, like fire. If she didn't know who the real hero and villain were in that play, Persephone would have been enraptured by the glory, gallantry, and grand heroics of Nephron. The population of the camp burst out of the line of tents with shouts and cries. They migrated into the open to better see the spectacle on Dragon Hill. Hundreds pushed forward for the chance to witness, then became strangely silent.
"Persephone," Malcolm called to her. She was walking forward, heading toward the hill, picking up speed.
The dragon snapped at Nephron with its massive jaws. Nephron swung the sword. Neither landed a blow. Persephone had hold of her cloak and gown, clutching the skirts in her fists, hiking them as she ran up the slope. A firm hand caught her at the elbow and spun her around.
"Wait," Malcolm ordered.
"I have to stop it."
"You can't.
It's Wraith. The dragon is Wraith."
"It's not. He's dead."
She jerked and pulled, but Malcolm refused to release her. On the hill, the dragon reared and sucked in air. It happened so quickly she didn't have time to think, feel, or choose sides. Fire blasted from the beast's mouth and struck Nephron, engulfing him in a torrent of flame. Persephone held her breath as she watched with wide eyes, unable to look away. She fully expected to see Nephron collapse in a pile of ash, but her husband didn't fall, didn't waver. All around the top of that hill, snow turned to steam, creating a hissing fog. Through it all, Nephron held the black bronze weapon high. When the fire stopped, the hilltop was scorched black. Rivers, born of melted snow, ran. In the following silence, the rushing water was loud. Fog lingered. A heavy mist engulfed the top of the hill. The wind blew, the haze cleared, and the sun continued to glint off shining armor. Nephron remained on his feet, undaunted and unscathed. "He's alive," Persephone said.
"Nephron's armor is etched in Orinfar, and that isn't a real dragon. It's a magical representation of one." Malcolm let go of her arm. "Future generations will know of this moment. Nephron will always be seen as he is now, a gleaming hero on a hilltop. The story of his battle will be told and retold, and with the passing generations exaggerated beyond all reason."
"Exaggerated? How could this be exaggerated?" Free of Malcolm's arm, Persephone charged up the hill. The ground was slick with snow, ice, and rivulets of water, and Persephone slid back one step for every two forward. She was halfway to the top when the dragon beat its wings hard. She paused in her climb to look. The dragon appeared to be flying away. Up it went in a spiral, corkscrewing higher and higher. She stood, head back, watching it rise. "Go," she thought. "Fly away. You can't beat him. Save yourself." The dragon dived. "Even now," she cried, watching it streak down. They were no longer his words. They were hers. Plummeting, claws extended and aimed at Nephron. Backed with enough force to turn stone to powder, the dragon descended. Persephone wanted to look away, but couldn't. She had to see. Looking brave and valiant, Nephron aimed his sword at the sky, at the screeching death from above. The moment they collided, the instant the sword blade impaled the dragon, the hilltop exploded. Snapping the bonds that created the beast, the world reclaimed the energy in a sudden, violent outburst. The eruption of force threw Nephron to the ground. The shockwave continued down the hill, radiating out in all directions. Snow burst into the air, tents flattened all across the camp, and Persephone, like everyone, was knocked off her feet, blown down by a violent gust of air. When Persephone opened her eyes, Nephron was standing over her. The sun was still illuminating him, so that he appeared a light unto himself, a beacon in the growing darkness, but one that cast a long shadow. "We are leaving," he told her. No anger, rage, hint of gloating or insult filled his voice. He merely stated a fact. "Without the dragon, there is..." Nephron stopped and looked past her. From behind, Persephone heard the crush of snow as someone approached. Pushing off the burnt, wet grass, she climbed to her feet. Turning, she found Malcolm standing there. In his hands, he held a ram's horn.
"Is that..."
Nephron asked, his gaze shifting between the thing in Malcolm's hand and the man's face. Malcolm nodded.
"But how?"
Malcolm stepped aside, revealing a figure sitting in the snow just down the hillside, a woman in a tattered cloak that hung off one shoulder. The hair from her bowed head covered her face. Hunched over and almost prostrate, she appeared exhausted as she sat beside Gifford's horse, Narrowspur. Still, Persephone knew her.
"Prynne?"
She whispered the name, casting it forth as a sacred wish, a prayer, wanting so badly for it to be true.
"Prynne!" she called louder.
The woman's head tilted. A quivering hand came up and parted the hair, revealing weary eyes, wind-beaten cheeks, and cracked lips.
"Rin!" Persephone shouted, then ran to the keeper's side. The Keenik tightly wrapped the young woman in her arms. "Oh, Brin, Brin, Brin!" she cried.
Malcolm held out the horn to Nefren. "I promised you the world, and I'm handing it to you now. Blow this. If you do, the war will end, and you'll rule both sides of the Nidwalden. I don't want to rule them. I want to kill them. I understand. But that's not one of your choices. Once that sun sets, Wanderlei, with his fleet of dragons and army of Myrilith, will be fain. You can either blow this and fight him for the Forest Throne, or refuse and accept both defeat and your own death. The choice is yours."
Bryn's clothes were soaked, and she shivered within Persephone's embrace. She must be freezing to death.
The keeper looked so tired, beyond exhausted. She was used up, empty and withered.
The woman lifted her head clear of Persephone and glared at Nefren.
"Blow it!"
she begged in a desperate voice.
"We all died bringing it to you. I'm the only one to make it back. Blow it! For the love of Elan, do it!"
"We all died." Persephone felt the words as much as heard them. And in that moment, she remembered a girl mystic with strange tattoos and a white wolf standing in her darkened lodge. "I came to tell you that we're all going to die. All of us." But it wasn't us, Persephone realized. It was them. Everyone she had ever loved had died. Even Brin. Yes, she was back. But could anyone fully return from such a thing?
Silence caused her to look over.
With a non-committal expression on his face, Nefren took the horn and weighed it in his hand. He sneered at the thing.
"Wanderlei, eh? Lothian's son. There's a certain symmetry in that, don't you think?"
Malcolm asked. Nefren considered this, and a smile tugged at the corners of his lips. He raised the horn and blew. Chapter 22. The Horn Blower. Turns out, Wanderlei did not expect his musical debut to be a duet.
The Book of Brin.
Wanderlei sat on the forest throne. He'd never done so before. His father wasn't the type to indulge his child with even a momentary sit in the big chair. Wanderlei wasn't at all certain what a father did or was supposed to do. But he figured that since Lothian had been a failure at everything else, it only followed he was a bad father. The throne was about as comfortable as one would expect from a chair made out of intertwined living trees. Thankfully, the bark had worn away, but Wanderlei still insisted on using a pillow. The seat was also weirdly sized, seemingly built for a giant. The armrests were too high, the seat itself too wide and deep. He had to either sit a mile from the backrest or have his feet stick up in the air like a child. Wanderlei had hoped sitting there would help him feel more confident, more self-assured. Instead, the throne only made him feel small. The seat wasn't his yet, but that didn't matter. He was the only Myrilith in the city, assuming the rune and her wolf had left. Reports of her taking the road west were plentiful. No one had tried to stop her, least of all Wanderlei. Those in the city had heard what she'd done and where she'd been. No one was concerned that she had assaulted their prince, but everyone was fascinated that she'd entered the garden door. Already, the rune and her white wolf were slipping into the realm of legend. Wanderlei had murdered his father on the floor of the Erinthian, but all people talked about was how impressive the rune had appeared in that formal Asica carrying the horn of Glyndora, and how blue the wolf's eyes had been. Wanderlei was happy no one had tried to stop her. Happy she was gone. Until he heard the horn blow. It happened as the sun set. Everyone heard it. The sound pierced the ear like teeth scraping metal. Now he needed answers. Wanderlei was shifting in his seat, trying to center the pillow, when the Aquila were ushered into the throne room by palace guards. The Fane's soldiers had heard about Wanderlei killing his father. They also knew the entire Aquila had been complicit in the act. Wanderlei had explained the whole thing to them while reminding each he was blessed with the protection of Feral. He also reminded them that he was the only remaining Miralith within 3 days of the city. Then he asked for their loyalty. Unsurprisingly, none had refused. Wanderlei had considered executing the Aquila right away. He'd almost done it that night, imagining a grand public barbecue right in the plaza. But he held off. He wasn't Fane yet. He didn't know all the rules, and while he was invulnerable for now, he guessed that this wouldn't last. Slaughtering the whole of the Aquila, the leaders of each tribe, might anger too many. It could spark a full-scale revolt. Best to wait until after I am enthroned, he thought. And I want Imali to personally crown me. He felt that would be the sweetest victory of all. So he had them imprisoned. All of them. Including Vasek and a handful of others he suspected of being sympathizers. Executions would begin the day after his coronation. Imali and Volhoric came in first, followed closely by Osler. The two ringleaders held hands like lovers. Wanderlei suspected the High Priest and the Curator hated each other now, but fear made friends of everyone. Nanegal and Heman came next. They didn't hold hands, but they bumped shoulders as if neither one wanted to be the first or last into the room, as if there might be a penalty for either. The five crept forward, huddling in a tight group. Wanderlei had heard sheep did the same thing because the odd one out got eaten. While Imali did nothing, Volhoric bowed. Your Highness, Imali said. Not my Fane, Wanderlei noted. Who blew the horn? He demanded. The fact he had heard its blast at all was a positive sign. It meant he was still frey enough to participate in the ritual. But the fear of not knowing who he would face in battle was making him sick. He felt nauseous. How would we know? Imali replied. Being locked in the cellar makes it difficult to be informed. Truth be told, my Fane, we are in uncharted territory here, Volhoric said. So how do I know who to fight? Anxiety leaked into Wanderlei's words, which alarmed all of them. Each took a step back. Wanderlei's frustration rose. Don't you have some way of locating it? Did it reach the river? Did it get to Avimpartha? That was his real concern, his greatest fear. If the horn had somehow managed to travel all the way to the tower, then he could face another Miralith. Wanderlei was confident in his ability to defeat any non-artist, but he doubted he could stand up against even the weakest of his own kind. I failed in combat against a rune. What chance do I have against someone like Jared, even as old as he is? If he is the one who blew it. The thought terrified Wanderlei. I don't see how, Nanegal said. Avimpartha is 3 days away. Maybe it would be possible with a good horse, Osler said. It could travel 100 miles a day, but it would probably drop dead right after. Still, it might be possible, and Avimpartha isn't nearly that far, is it? She looked at the others. The rune didn't have a horse. I'm not even certain their kind can ride one, Wanderlei replied. If I may, Imali started. Surely there has been reports of the rune's movements since leaving the Arenthian. If you could provide us with what's been reported to you, perhaps we could aid you better. Oh, yes. You're always the helpful one, aren't you, traitor? Wanderlei calmed himself.
Eyewitnesses say they saw the rune take it inside the door, and she didn't have it when she came back out.
Shock washed over the faces of each of the Aquila members, their eyes widening.
Not even Amalia's that good at deception. She did not expect that.
Wanderlei's stomach had been in knots since he'd heard the report. Was he being challenged by someone who was dead? Or had it been that odd, filthy guy in the garden who had blown it? There wasn't anyone more obsessed than Tridos.
If that's the case, I'm done for. He's as talented as Jared. They both can create strawberries. I've never heard of any artist who can manifest something from nothingness.
When no one said anything, Wanderlei took a different tack.
What happens if the challenger never comes forth? What happens then?
The sheep shared more wide-eyed looks.
Ah!
Volhoric opened his yammering mouth again.
That has never happened. The challenger has always been eager to engage, either to fight or quickly concede. In the case of two combatants, they've always been together because the horn was always here. We've given each the chance to blow, and the ritual went on from there. It's not supposed to happen like this. It's just not.
Is there a time limit, like between the first and second sounding of the horn, a point after which I win by default if the challenger doesn't show up?
Like I said, we are on new ground here, my Thane. I suppose it's possible that everything will just wash out and start over,
Volhoric offered.
Wash out? Start over? What does that mean?
The High Priest didn't look at all certain of himself.
Maybe if the challenge isn't met, the whole process begins again.
You mean I'd have to blow the horn again?
Volhoric nodded.
Possibly.
This was almost more frightening than not knowing who had blown it in the first place, and Wanderlei's anger grew again.
We don't have the horn anymore! We can't have a do-over!
He pointed at them, sweeping his finger like a weapon. All of them shrank in terror as it passed over them.
Take them away! He yelled at the guards. Lock them up again! And no meals! Not even bread! Until I get real answers, I won't be able to eat! So they don't get to either!
The guards herded the group out, leaving Wanderlei alone on his ill-fitting chair. All manner of nightmares rushed at him.
Who can it be? A monster? Trilos? My father? A god? Feral himself might be coming to dole out punishment for my crime.
As far as Wanderlei knew, no one had ever murdered a Thane, then blown the challenge horn.
Perhaps this act had broken some universal law and summoned a deity to deliver retribution. In some strange way, he preferred the idea of having to fight Feral over having to face his own father.
He imagined Lothian returning from the dead, still blackened and charred, his eyes angry. Wanderlei put his head between his knees and cried.
Chapter 23. Losing Weight. The worst thing people can do to one another is also the best. Provide challenges. How we respond becomes our lives. How we live our lives becomes the best and the worst parts of our afterlives. The Book of Bryn.
Tesh saw that Ivar was right about the snow. Small, icy flakes pelted them and made a hissing sound where they struck the frost en masse. Gifford led them around the curve of the cliffs out into what Rhone's light revealed to be a wide canyon.
She's brighter than Bryn was,
Tesh thought, as he realized he could see from wall to wall. In between was a flat plain of white, littered with the broken pieces of the bridge. Rhone had pulled his arm around the back of her neck and was acting as a crutch, the same way she used to help Gifford.
I've become a burden.
Tesh looked at Gifford, who carried Tressa in his arms. His light was growing brighter.
He feeds off Roan. He lives for her. Who do I live for?
By the time they reached the base of the big pillar, they heard sounds unlike anything since they'd fallen in. The noise was odd, like thunder made from breaking glass. Down the length of the canyon that zigzagged with the randomness of a mammoth crack, they could see a reddish glow, and it was moving, growing bigger and brighter. Gifford set Tressa down gently, then tilted his head back and peered up at the long ascent.
They are attracted to your light, Roan. Is there any way you can turn it down? Can you think terrible thoughts?
Roan shook her head. I doubt you'd want me to, even if I could. We both need to be as light as possible in order to climb.
Only then did Tesh notice the connection between buoyancy and brilliance. To be without weight was to be light. Roan placed Tesh's hands on the rock as if he were drunk and they'd reached the door of his home.
I can't carry you up. You have to climb. You have to pull yourself up.
Tesh felt that miserable rock. Dry, rough, sharp and cruel.
I can't. I'm just too heavy.
Yes, you can. You know you can. You just have to decide to do it. You too, Tressa.
I'll never climb this thing, she said, looking up and uttering what was close to a laugh. I don't even know why you brought me.
The sound of the shattering thunder grew louder, and what looked to be sunrise stretched out across the horizon, becoming brighter but retaining that terrifying red color.
You have to try, Gifford told them.
The desperate way he rushed his words decided the matter for Tesh.
I will on one condition.
A condition?
Gifford said. We're doing that again.
Don't wait for us.
You're just giving up again.
No, I'm not.
Tesh nodded toward the red glow.
This could take time, and I already have enough weight to deal with. I can't add fear and guilt on top of it.
You and Roan go up. We'll either make it or we won't, but being responsible for your failure won't help.
Gifford looked at Roan, who shook her head.
He's lying, just as he did to Bryn.
Gifford frowned, then grabbed Tesh by the shoulders.
I want your word you'll do it.
You have it.
No, he said. I want your word on Bryn's eternal soul.
Tesh pushed back, but Gifford wouldn't let him go.
I want your word that you'll fight harder than you ever have, that you'll do whatever is necessary to climb this damn pillar. Swear it!
Tesh didn't make a sound.
Swear it, or so help me, we'll stay here and be eaten. Is that what you want? Is it?
No.
And you know us. We'll do it. We are just that crazy, both of us.
He looked at Roan, who promptly and emphatically nodded.
No one has ever called me sane, she said, without a hint of humour.
But there was something in her voice that surprised Tesh. Her tone was different. More alive. More free. The expression on her face was new, too. She was smiling, and not just with her lips. Her eyes sparkled. Roan was happy. She had always been a closed, cowering, sad person. Slow to speak, quiet and meek. The sort to content herself with the corners and dim places of the world where she could hide. But this shining woman was different. She was now able to tolerate Tesh's arm around her shoulder as they walked. Roan was healed. The word came to Tesh, and he thought it had never before been so aptly applied.
Gifford was right. They were both crazy. You want us to go? Swear it!
He gripped Tesh with powerful arms and slammed him against the rock.
You swallowed your stupid pride to learn how to fight from the very people who murdered your family. You did that for a memory. Are you telling me you won't even try for Bryn's sake? She's up there waiting for you. Do you care for her so little?
The lousy, culling cripple.
I loved her. You still do.
You idiot.
Just prove it. Swear to me now. Swear it.
In the distance, Tesh saw movement. Something was drawing toward them. Far too big to be a giant, this was the size of an open plain storm, where the clouds billowed up into huge formations, then darkened and rolled in. Typhons were not beings, so much as events. They were both the herald and the doom, the portent and the catastrophe. Seeing the horizon approach, Tesh understood how small they all were, and how foolish.
All right, I swear. Now both of you, get out of here.
Giffert stared a moment longer, then nodded.
See you at the top.
The going was easy for a while. Giffert just followed Roan, who hadn't the slightest trouble scaling the stone. Not that it was a hard climb. There were plenty of handholds and small ledges to rest on if they needed to. She didn't. Roan was inexhaustible. Him, not so much.
Need to stop,
he called up when they reached another ledge. Giffert had no idea how high they were. All he knew was that he couldn't see the bottom anymore. Tesh and Tressa had faded into the darkness.
Why?
She looked back down, all that brightness making it hard to see her face clearly.
I'm tired.
He threw himself on the foot-wide jut of stone.
This isn't easy.
How could you be tired? You don't have muscles? No lungs?
No, I don't know how, but I am. Are you saying you aren't even a little weary?
No more than walking.
She paused, analyzing his question as she did everything.
Actually, less.
Roan let go of her holds and dropped down to him, scaring Giffert so badly he yelled,
Don't do that! You could fall!
She bent low and looked into his eyes. She peered deep, tilting her head left, then right, as if trying to get a better angle. She was searching for something, peering into his house through the tiny windows of his eyes.
You have weight.
Of course I have weight. Everything has weight.
No, you don't, because you don't have a body. You have no more weight than a beam of light. Any heaviness you feel is something you're carrying. Giffert, you can't climb out with a burden. Don't you understand? That's the whole point of the abyss. To get out, you must clean house. Can't have so much as a dust bunny hiding under your bed. You need to lose it all. Hate, fear, guilt, regret.
Dust bunny? She'd been like this since forgiving Ivor. This is Roan as if there had never been an Ivor. This is the woman she was supposed to be before fate threw her off a cliff. He shook his head.
I don't have any of those.
You have something, and you won't make it out unless you let go.
Giffert looked down. The only thing he could clearly see were the three red points of light moving toward the base of the pillar.
Typhons, he muttered. Do you think Tressa and Tesh managed to climb high enough?
I don't know, Roan replied.
She sat down on the little ledge beside him and dangled her legs off the edge as if she were sitting in one of her hanging chairs in a round house.
Have we?
He looked at her, at that brilliance.
Are we high enough, do you think?
Roan looked down, leaning forward so far that Giffert held his breath. I think so. Giffert was seized by a jolt of fear.
Can Typhons climb?
Roan shook her head.
I doubt it, or they would have already.
Giffert peered back down at the lights that moved in a whirling mist that might have been snow or fog.
Yeah, I guess you're right.
He tried to spot Tesh or Tressa, hoped to see them scaling the pillar somewhere below them, but couldn't see anything.
I don't think either of them are going to make it. We shouldn't have left them.
Giffert?
What?
Stop,
she said, her eyes locked on him in that piercing manner.
Stop what?
Roan took his hand. She placed it between both of hers.
This isn't about them. It's about you.
Roan, there's nothing.
Giffert was telling the truth. He honestly couldn't think of any guilt or regret that might be holding him back. In his whole life, he'd never hurt anyone. Except the fray that had been on the verge of killing Roan, and he didn't have any guilt over that. His life was clean of mistakes, at least the sort that a person could feel regretful for. That was one of the benefits of being pitiful. He lacked the opportunity to be an ass.
Is it me?
Roan asked. She said it gently, inviting him to be honest, letting him know, with a squeeze of her hand and the acceptance in her eyes, that he could admit anything to her.
Something about me? Is it that I killed Ivor?
No! Gifford shouted, and took her hand in both of his. For a moment, he forgot they were on a tiny ledge so far above the ground that he couldn't see the bottom.
I love you, Roan. I always have. As far as I'm concerned, you're perfect. Now more than ever.
Then what is it?
Gifford sighed. I can't imagine.
I've been happy with you. I really have. Since the Battle of Cranford, my life has been far beyond my greatest hopes. I mean, I really thought I couldn't imagine that you, that anyone would...
Would what?
She put a lock of hair in her mouth and began to chew as she leaned closer, those eyes of hers boring in, trying to pry him open, trying to solve the puzzle.
I don't know.
Yes, you do. Tell me, what couldn't you imagine? He shrugged.
I don't know. I guess, well, okay. I couldn't imagine that anyone would want to be with me. You know?
Why? She stared at him, appearing dumbfounded. With anyone else, he would have known it was an act, and he would have accused her of pretending to be stupid. There were two problems with that, of course. Roan didn't understand pretend, and she was anything but stupid.
She really doesn't know.
He pointed up.
Because up there, I'm a cripple.
Roan's brow furrowed, and she shifted her eyes side to side as she struggled to understand.
Roan, how can you not see this? He said in frustration. Up there I'm grotesque, a hunchback who can't talk, can't walk. I'm someone to be shunned, someone to throw rotted food at.
Roan stopped puzzling. Instead, her eyes began to blink rapidly. Her lips trembled.
Who threw food at you?
Everyone.
I didn't,
she shouted, her chest rising and falling, her eyes filling with tears.
Okay, not everyone, but a lot of people did. And worse.
They beat you? A bitter little laugh escaped Gifford.
Why do you think I wore long sleeves in summer? Couldn't hide my face, though. Didn't matter. People didn't look at me.
Still don't.
When I walk... He laughed again. When I hobble by, people pretend I'm not there.
They don't like looking.
Don't like seeing. Don't know why. Maybe they're afraid they can catch my condition. Even the nice people.
Even Moya and Persephone. I can tell they're pretending I'm normal. But I'm not. They look so embarrassed when they can't understand what I say, as if it's their fault I can't talk.
I pretend I don't notice that they feel awkward, and we stand there, both pretending. Them, that they don't really want to be someplace else, and me, that I don't know they want to get away.
I never felt that way. Tears slipped down Roan's face.
Oh, I hate making you cry. I know, Roan. You never saw me as different. That's why I fell in love with you. You were the only one who never knew I was crippled.
But everyone else did, she said.
Gifford nodded.
Even the nice ones, she added. Even your friends.
Again, he nodded.
That's your rock, she told him. That's the weight.
Gifford stared at her.
He stopped breathing. There was a pain rising in him. The sort of hot burning that comes after numbness when toes or fingers come back to life.
I pretended.
Roan was nodding, encouraging him to see, to accept. She squeezed his hand, knowing the anguish was rushing in, all of it coming back in a terrible, horrific assault.
I pretended for so long, convinced myself that it didn't hurt. But it did. It does. The pain is terrible.
You can let all that go, Roan told him. He looked at her through blurry eyes.
How?
Because now you know.
Know what?
He begged. She took his face in her hands, and he felt as if the sun itself were smiling at him.
That you're not a cripple. That you never were.
Like any truth, upon hearing it, Gifford felt stupid. But feeling stupid next to Rowan wasn't like being a cripple, and he felt the weight fall as he reached out and hugged his wife, and light filled their world.
I carried a boulder. Rowan kissed him. You had the same weight, only in countless pebbles.
The silent stillness of that place had been so deafening that to Tesh, wind-whipping snow was loud. The flakes had grown big, and they flew in a turmoil, making it hard for him even to see Tressa, who lay only a few feet away. It wasn't just the snow. Rowan and Gifford were long gone, having ascended beyond what the snowstorm let them see. The only light at the base of the pillar was the distant but steadily growing glow of red that inched into view like a bloody sunrise.
Go on, Tesh, Tressa said.
She was lying at the base of the pillar, her legs tucked under like a wounded fawn, well on her way to being buried. Frosted in snow, her hair and eyelashes were dusted white. She appeared to be a very old woman, withered and wan.
You say that as if I have a choice,
he shouted to be heard over the howling wind.
It's screaming.
Tesh heard the cries carried past them as if lost, disembodied souls were being driven before the red, glowing ploughs.
That's where we all go. We melt, erode away, but still can't escape the abyss.
Maybe not melt. Maybe we freeze.
He looked at the icy snow. Maybe it wasn't snow at all.
You do,
Tressa told him, her voice already matching the raspy tone of the blasting snow.
If I do, you do too. What's my choice?
Tressa asked.
To climb up there and do what? Reunite with my beloved husband? Serve the queen?
She tried to laugh, ended up coughing, pretended to spit, then settled for a good, long, defiant stare through the whirling flakes that clustered on her face.
I'd rather stay anchored here by my pride than face that eternity.
But you have Bryn.
She lost her insolence just speaking the name, and Tesh could see a bitter shadow of envy pass through her eyes.
She's a good woman, Tesh. A really good woman. If Conniger had ever shown me just a hint, even a suggestion that he could be so much as a blister on her foot.
She shook off a frown made by biting her lower lip, then lifted her gaze and peered up at the pillar.
I'd be up there already. I'd climb that stone if I had to strip naked and kiss everyone's ass who ever spat on me. You're an idiot if you don't see that. You're down here, and she's up there waiting. That's just stupid.
She's not up there anymore. Tesh wiped the flakes from her eyes. Unlike real snow, these didn't melt. Maybe because, unlike real skin, neither of them was warm. She's gone.
You don't know how long it's been.
It's been forever. You know that. Doesn't even matter. I'll still eventually end up here in Nifril, and she won't. A sudden burst of shrieks ripped past in the rosy distance. Tesh heard the first jarring footfalls, which made a terrible whoomp sound.
Oh,
Tressa nodded, acting as if she didn't notice.
So that's it. That's your problem, eh? Even if you make it, you don't, right? But you still have time. You're still young. If you returned to Elan and lived a better... I murdered 5 people who thought I was their friend. That's not something to erase with an apology.
The rising red light was bright enough to make the cliff walls look like they were covered in blood, and Tressa's face appeared rosy.
I believed it was justice. Whose?
Mine, I guess.
Most of us call that revenge.
Yeah, I can see that now. Thanks for being there for me, Tressa.
Whoomp. The ground shook, and some snow fell off the upper ledges of the pillar, raining down with a hiss. Tressa blinked away a ridge of snowflakes that had gathered once more on her lashes, and for a moment she lost her hard edge. She was surrendering, giving up, and in that moment, Tressa revealed a woman who, in another place and time, might have been pleasing.
I'm not getting out of here, Tess. Not ever. I'll melt away. But if I had any light left, I'd give it to you. I would give you everything I had.
Tesh couldn't help himself. He reached out and hugged Tressa tight to his chest. The Typhons, who had so quaked the abyss, stopped for a very long time. Nothing happened. Then slowly the Typhons began to walk away. What they had come for was gone. The stars that had fallen had flown out again, and the hope that had briefly filled their world was gone. All that remained was the darkness of Tressa and Tesh, and the bitterness that rendered them invisible.
Chapter 24. News from the Tower.
I still remember him the way he looked when he came to Dal Ren. Young, arrogant, selfish, cruel, entitled. When I saw him again, I was surprised to learn that while half a decade of war and the loss of parents had utterly transformed me, it hadn't changed him at all. The Book of Bryn.
Wanderlei stood staring at his room. This chamber and a half filled with a bed, a small desk, some shelves, and a window that looked out on the Shinara River had been his home for the last 30 years. On the mattress was the formal assegai he'd worn the first time he visited the Rose Bridge. Beside it lay the grey cloak, the terrible one made by Inga and Flynn, his badge of rebellion. He'd kept it all these years in the bottom of the chest in his closet. Why, he didn't know. Looking at it now, he saw a pathetic thing. The sad efforts of children playing at being adults. On top was the gold chain Grindel had given Wanderlei on his 20th birthday. He'd thought it was a necklace at first, but Grindel had explained it was to be worn between a pierced ear and a pierced nose. Wanderlei, who winced when having his toenails clipped, never got around to wearing the gift.
Aren't you excited to be moving? Treya asked, her tone far too happy to suit him.
Wanderlei knew he should be, but he wasn't. He tried to sort out his feelings, even as Treya sorted his belongings. This small space had always been his home, the place he lived for his entire life. As Treya excavated, he was shocked at how few artifacts she unearthed. An old pair of shoes he loved so much that he'd refused to discard them, despite their holes. The winter cloak he'd worn on the night he and Macaretta had come together in the Arinthian. And a rock he had found on the banks of the Shinara that looked like a lumbering bear. They were all added to a small pile of clothing. The little glass fishbowl remained on the table beside his bed. The goldfish had died weeks ago, but he hadn't replaced it. Wanderlei discovered he both loved and hated the room, and he was bewildered how such contradictions could coexist.
I'll have the tailor up to make proper measurements for your new clothes, Treya said. You'll want something special for your coronation.
He frowned at the word. All it did was remind him that someone had blown the horn and no one knew who or what he would have to fight.
I don't care what I wear.
He flung himself down on the bed, making the gold chain chime.
Of course you do, Treya said. A new fane needs to project dignity to his people.
I don't think I'm going to be fane.
Treya stopped. She'd been down on her hands and knees, going through the back boxes of his closet, but crawled out and stood to face him.
Why do you say that?
Because it's true. I've been challenged. Whoever blew the horn did it knowing they could beat me. Why else would they?
It has to be a Miralith. Vidar or Jerid, probably.
I've threatened both with execution if I became Thane. I'd blow it if I were them.
Wanderlei saw this as the best case. He still harbored fears and suffered nightmares that he might face an undead, char-broiled father. He almost voiced this concern to Treya, but held back. He didn't want her to think him a coward. Treya, he'd come to realize over the last few days, was his only living friend. Not that he had many to start with. Grindel was on that list. Macaretta transcended it. Then there was Imali. But she had only pretended to be his friend. She'd done a fine job. Even after everything, he still craved her approval. Wanderlei wanted Imali to change her mind about him. He felt he still might prove his worth, show her how wrong she'd been, and regain her respect. Wanderlei also knew this was a fantasy. He'd never had her respect. He ought to have killed her that night in the Orinthian, but he couldn't bring himself to do it. He hated the ugly curator. She had stolen his soul, killed Macaretta and his father, and yet she was still the closest thing he'd ever had to a mother.
"You'll be fine," Treya said. "You have strength, you have skill, and you have youth on your side. Those others are dusty old Frey. The bodies and minds cannot compete with yours."
"Dusty," he said, amused. "I thought I was the only one who said that."
Treya smiled at him, an odd, embarrassed look.
"What?"
he asked. Treya looked around the room at the disarray that was Mondelez's life. She took a breath and bit her lip.
"What is it?"
"I suppose it doesn't matter anymore. Your father is dead."
"What doesn't matter?"
She hesitated. "It's been so long. It feels strange to think that I could..."
She stopped again, looking like she was suffering indigestion.
"Could what?"
"It's a secret, and I've kept it for so long that breaking my silence is scary."
She had both hands on her stomach as she looked toward the window as if she wanted to go there, but didn't move.
"Maybe it is an upset stomach. Perhaps she needs to vomit. But, like I said, it doesn't matter now. Lothian is gone, and my vow was to him. That was the agreement we had. I would be allowed to be near you, to nurse and raise you, but I could never do more than that. I could never tell you the truth."
Treya's expression became pained, and the hands that had lain against her stomach came up and pressed to her cheeks. She shook her head and looked away.
"I'm sorry, but..."
"Wanderlei!"
He gasped. The voice did not come from the room, not from Treya, certainly. This was the harsh, demanding voice of a dusty old Miralith.
"Jerid?
I didn't catch you on the privy, did I?"
the old Kel asked.
"Or on top of some terrified junior..."